This is Healthy Rounds with Dr. Anthony Alessi. Sponsored by Hartford Healthcare, Rochford Eye Center, St. Francis Hospital, Covaris, and Yukon Health Orthopedics and Sports Medicine. Healthy Rounds provides general information regarding medical conditions and diseases. The information is not intended to create a doctor-patient relationship. You're encouraged to consult your own medical provider for advice that applies to your own medical care. And now, Dr. Anthony Alessi on WTIC News Talk 1080 and WTIC.com.
Welcome to Healthy Rounds, the show that provides you with up-to-date medical information, and we answer all of your health questions. I'm your host, Dr. Anthony Alessi, and it's great to be with you on this Saturday morning. And today we have kind of a special show from the standpoint that I have two guests coming on. The first is going to be Dr. Corey Dwyer. Dr. Dwyer has been a patient on our program before, and the reason I brought him back and I did a taped interview about shoulder dislocation. So I had a question from one of our listeners about shoulder dislocation, and I thought I would pose the question to him when I saw him in clinic in person. So I taped the interview quickly, and we're going to play that in the second segment. The next is, my guest will be in the second half hour, Dr. Pamela Ori-Zazamia. Dr. Ori-Zazamia is an endocrinologist, and we're going to talk about thyroid disease. Dr. Zazamia is a board-certified endocrinologist. She's in solo private practice, something we don't see anymore these days. Really a throwback to when people got very individualized care and something that goes against the tide, right? Everybody's joining groups, and groups become bigger groups, and you wait forever at times to get into people. So it's interesting because this young woman has gone out and started a solo private practice, giving her patients more access and direct access to her. She's it, right? She's the doctor. So very interesting, and I've been wanting to get someone on to really talk about thyroid disease since this always comes up. This past week, though, I had the opportunity to participate in a charity event for the UConn golf team. And a regular listener came up to me and introduced herself, Maureen. And I asked, as I always ask, is there a show you might want me to put on? Is there a topic you want us to hit? And she brought up the topic of back pain. So I'm working, Maureen, on getting someone on to talk about non-operative treatment of back pain. I think that's someone, most of our listeners, it's a topic people can identify with as we try to treat back pain. And some people say in this country that we operate too quickly on back pain, where physical therapy is more common in other countries to treat that. So I'm working on that. And, you know, if you folks have questions or you have ideas and shows you want to hear about, just email me over at info@alessimd.com. This day in medicine, June 15th, is the Feast of St. Vitus. Interesting. And St. Vitus, V-I-T-U-S, it's actually translated to the name of Guy, or in Italian, Guido. And St. Vitus was a Sicilian martyr during the Middle Ages, died in A.D. 303. And some of you will be familiar with it, the name, because of the term St. Vitus dance. And that was the term that was applied to Sydenham's chorea. So Sydenham's chorea is a rheumatologic chorea. And when we use the term chorea, we're talking about these uncoordinated, involuntary movements of the face, arms, and legs. So there's this movement disorder that's brought on when someone gets rheumatic fever, which is caused by streptococcus infection. It happens in about 20 to 30% of children who have rheumatic fever, and usually in the ages of 5 to 15. It gets better, and recovery though, can take up to 3 months. And it's very disturbing, obviously, for families to see and parents to see their children with these movements. What was interesting is, as a result of this, and St. Vitus, by the way, became a saint because he was martyred because he would not give up his faith. And he was attributed to performing an exorcism at age 7. And that's how we got to the term St. Vitus Dance. But St. Vitus is also the patron saint of dancers as a result of this change and this coincidence. So we remember that feast today, and we remember, more importantly, the medical condition. A term we're starting to see more and more of is cognitive reserve. And this is how we apply to mental cognitive disorders. So as we get older, right, we start losing our ability to think quickly, remember names, and some folks in developing a dementia. So there is always this ongoing discussion about, can you build your cognitive reserve? And recent studies have looked at this, that because we know cognitive decline starts in about midlife. So this cognitive reserve is something people feel builds up. For example, if in your career or in your work you had a lot of cognitive demands, you were practiced in a profession that demanded a lot of intense thinking, reading, and things such as that. Now, a lot of people try to, get that in doing games and puzzles. And a lot of this we don't know about. But the question has always been, can this cognitive reserve, this buildup in cognitive reserve, delay a cognitive decline and the onset of dementia? And there are some recent studies that indicate that. Now, it's not an easy study to do, right? Because there are so many variables to it. So what they have been doing is looking at large populations and basing it on these people's careers and the onset of dementia. So there's a lot more to be done about that, but certainly something to bear in mind as we go through and think about ways in which we could avoid our own cognitive decline. We're going to take a short break now, and then we're going to be back with the interview I did with Dr. Corey Dwyer talking about shoulder dislocation. If you have any questions for me, you can get them. I'm online now at info@alessimd.com. You're listening to Healthy Rounds on WTIC News Talk 1080. We're back on Healthy Rounds. As I mentioned, on this segment of Healthy Rounds, we're going to talk a little bit with Dr. Corey Dwyer. Dr. Dwyer is an assistant professor of orthopedic surgery at the University of Connecticut. And I posed the question to him in the interview about shoulder dislocation. When do we see it in the regular population, in athletes, and what does it all imply? So Kevin's going to roll that interview, and then we'll be back to talk a little bit more about it.
This is Dr. Anthony Alessi, and I'm back with Dr. Corey Dwyer. Dr. Dwyer is an assistant professor of orthopedic surgery at the University of Connecticut, specializing in shoulder injuries. And several questions have come up regarding shoulder dislocations. Are we seeing it more? Are we identifying them more? And people have had a lot of questions about that, surgical implications and things such as that, also the hereditary issues behind it. So I decided to have a little chat with Dr. Dwyer. Corey, welcome back to the show.
Thanks for having me again.
So let's talk about shoulder dislocation when we hear about that. Who do we see it in? Are we seeing more of it now? Can you give us some background to it?
Sure. So a shoulder dislocation is when the upper arm bone, the humerus, pops out of the socket, part of the scapula. So typically we talk about joints being ball and socket joints, but the shoulder is actually the most mobile joint in the body. And there are different things that keep it stable. So we talk about the bones keep it stable. There's also an O-ring of tissue called the labrum that helps provide stability. And last, you also have your rotator cuff muscles that will provide stability for the shoulder.
So when people dislocate it, why? Why are they dislocating? Is it typically, I've seen it a lot in professional bull riders, obviously, from trauma because they're stressing their arms so much. Is trauma the biggest reason why we see people dislocate their shoulders?
That's correct. So trauma is the most common reason for a shoulder dislocation, but there could be things that risk factors that cause someone more prone to dislocate. Some people are inherently built with naturally looser ligaments, or there could be a chronic repetitive nature that leads someone prone to dislocate.
So when we hear about shoulder dislocation, we also hear about it being an anterior dislocation or a posterior dislocation. What's the difference?
So if you use that analogy, I like to tell patients that the shoulder is essentially like a golf ball and a tee. So if that golf ball, the humerus, pops forward, that's an anterior dislocation, which is the most common, but it can also pop backwards towards the back. And there are certain patients that are prone to that, but most common it's the anterior dislocation.
When we think of implications, so from, blood vessels, nerves, which is more likely, is it common to have disruption of blood vessels and nerves when you dislocate your shoulder?
More commonly, it can stretch some of the nerves in the shoulder, and you can have some numbness and tingling on the outside of your shoulder. So that's one of the important things that we check at our first visit or right there immediately if we're on the sidelines for someone dislocating their shoulder.
So at what point does someone need surgery for a shoulder dislocation? So, for example, in neurology, we often see people with epilepsy who may have a generalized seizure, and they're always dislocating their shoulder as part of the seizure from the trauma, from the tonic-clonic movement. So in what people are you saying we need to do some surgery, and what surgery would you do?
Yeah, well, there are a variety of reasons why someone dislocates their shoulder, and I think you bring up a good point about seizures, and seizure control is very important before considering a surgical intervention, because I would hate to have to put someone through that surgery if we don't have the seizures under control, because that could put them through more trauma. But I think, breaking it down, after someone dislocates their shoulder, it's important to first reduce the shoulder. And there's a variety of different ways, whether that can be done on the sideline versus in the emergency department, followed by there will be a period of rehabilitation, which is important to, in a controlled manner, get back some of your motion so you don't get too stiff. And then last, we have to consider a patient on a case-by-case situation. We know that if you're younger and you perform contact sports, that you're more prone to have a recurrent dislocation, which can have subsequent effects downstream, such as injury to your cartilage or to the tendons around the shoulder joint.
When we think about, actually, it's kind of interesting, you bring up the point where in athletes, it's only in athletes where when someone has an injury, you assume it's going to happen again. Okay, whereas other people, you don't assume they're going to get into another car accident.
I hope not, yeah.
But what's one thing our audience should know about shoulder dislocation, if it happens or if they are prone to it, if there's some new bit of research or something that people should know in general?
Yeah, I think it's really important that those structures that I talked about earlier, considering the bone, considering the ligaments and the tendons, I think rehab is going to be very key in part of that. But I think it's having a surgeon who's very critical of those structures. Thankfully, here at UConn, we have some of the pioneers in shoulder instability. So we like to get the appropriate imaging whether that's at first x-rays or eventually an MRI, maybe even a CAT scan, because we want to take all those things into consideration and tailor the surgery. So I guess the take home is not every shoulder dislocation is created equal, because we try to tailor it for the patient in the actual injury that they've sustained.
Corey, thanks again. Thanks for your time today, and thanks for always being available with some good information.
Thanks for having me.
I want to thank Dr. Corey Dwyer for spending some time with us on that. I think one of the things I learned from that interview was the fact that when this happens in young athletes, that they will be more prone to having it happen later on. And I think the proviso being if they don't take the proper steps. And in doing so, we have to think about that when we have children playing contact sports, especially football. And if you dislocate a shoulder at a very young age, you want to make sure that you have a good physical therapist to work with. And I think that's true across the board with shoulder injuries. We talked a little bit about, you know, putting together a future program on the use of physical therapy for back injury. But especially with shoulder injuries, physical therapy, because of the complexity of the joint, as Dr. Dwyer explained, and the muscles and ligaments that hold it in place, our consideration has to be good physical therapy to rehabilitate the joint and avoid further problems. The other thing that he talked about, and something that I encounter quite a bit, is nerve injury when dislocating the shoulder because of the stress you put on what we call the brachial plexus. The plexus is, to draw the analogy, kind of a junction box. If you think of the electricity in your basement where you have all the fuses, there's this big box where trunks come in and then smaller wires come out. And that's the same way the brachial plexus works. It's a junction box for nerves from the spine to go down to the arm. So when you have a dislocation and you put traction on that, it's not uncommon to have symptoms of numbness, tingling, and weakness as well in the arm. So things to bear in mind. We're going to take a short break. Then we're going to be back with my guest in the second half hour of the program, Dr. Pamela Ori-Zazamia. And we're talking with her. She's an endocrinologist. She's board certified in endocrinology. But I wanted to get someone on to talk about thyroid disease and the symptoms when you first present with thyroid disease. We're going to talk about treatments. We're going to talk about thyroid cancer. We're going to talk about the workups that can be done to evaluate thyroid disease. And I think she's going to have some very helpful information for all our listeners when you go for your regular checkup for your general care. So we're going to be back with Dr. Pamela Ori-Zazamia. We're going to take a short break, and then we'll be back with more of Healthy Rounds. You're listening to Healthy Rounds on WTIC News Talk 1080. We're back on Healthy Rounds. I'm your host, Dr. Anthony Alessi. And it's great to have in this segment is my guest, Dr. Pamela Ori-Zazamia. And Dr. Ori-Zazamia is a board-certified endocrinologist. And I wanted to get her on to talk a little bit about thyroid disease. But before we get started, Pam, tell everybody a little bit about yourself, your training, and why you chose endocrinology.
Okay. Well, hi, Tony. Thank you so much for having me on today. So I am an endocrinologist. I have a practice in Enfield, Connecticut called Monarch Endocrinology. And I initially did my med school in Philadelphia. From there, I moved in 2013 to Connecticut, and I did 3 years of internal medicine in Farmington, Connecticut at UConn Health. And then after that, I went on to my endocrinology fellowship for an additional 2 years at UConn Health as well. And initially what interested me in endocrinology was just hormones and how fascinating they are and the way that they interact with the body. But one thing that I did find in my training was just how much the hormone imbalances can impact the quality of life for patients. And by being an endocrinologist, I get to treat diseases like osteoporosis, but then also, you know, help people with their thyroid and different things that really impact their quality of life long term.
I have to tell you that I'm more intrigued and in awe of the fact that you went out into solo private practice. And it's something we don't see very often. And, you know, I think it's such a great option for patients. What made you decide to take that leap, especially as a young female physician?
So one of the big drivers in that for me was I wanted to be able to decide on my own how much time I had to spend with my patients. I really like spending a lot of time talking to people, you know, hearing about what is going on with their health, answering all of their questions. And by having my own practice and kind of doing things this way, I can spend as much time as I want with my patients, and there really are no constraints there.
And that's the biggest gripe. When you talk to patients, the biggest gripe with a visit with a physician is the amount of time they have. And the other thing is access, being able to get in without waiting 6 months. And it's interesting because you've taken care of both of those obstacles by going into solo practice. I have to tell you, I admire the fact that you've done that because we see it so little. But let's get back to the thyroid disease. What do we know about the thyroid gland and you know, how does it function?
So the thyroid gland, it's a small gland that sits kind of at the bottom of the neck. It looks like a butterfly. So it has two lobes, a right lobe and a left lobe, and each one of those looks a little bit like a wing of a butterfly. And then there's the centerpiece that we call the isthmus that connects the two lobes, and that goes right over the windpipe in the neck. And the thyroid gland makes hormones called thyroid hormones. And those hormones impact all different aspects of our body. So they help with your heart rate, maintaining a good heart rate and blood pressure, maintaining your metabolism, keeping your hair, skin, and nails healthy, keeping kind of your bowel movements regular. And also for younger females, it helps with regulating your menstruation. So it kind of affects all aspects of the body.
When we think about thyroid function, we hear the terms hypothyroid, hyperthyroid, euthyroid. Can you explain those problems or those diagnoses and what those symptoms are?
Yeah, so you know, hypothyroidism is when your thyroid gland isn't making enough thyroid hormone. So you have what we call a deficiency of thyroid hormone. And the way that that shows up on labs is a little bit different than you would expect. It actually shows up with your TSH, which is the marker of, you know, your thyroid function, that being high on the labs. When that's high, that means that your thyroid gland actually isn't making enough thyroid hormone. And some symptoms of hypothyroidism are, first, fatigue. People say that they feel very tired. They're, you know, just regardless of how much they're sleeping and how much rest they feel they're getting, they still feel very tired throughout the day. Also, hair loss, constipation, weight gain, and some dry skin, and sometimes some issues with their nails kind of not growing as well as they should be. Hyperthyroidism, on the other hand, is when you have too much thyroid hormone. Your body's making too much. And the TSH, the thyroid stimulating hormone, that lab that we just mentioned, would be a little bit low in those cases. And symptoms of hyperthyroidism are, first, feeling like your heart is racing. So your heart rate is fast. You feel like it's racing and pounding very hard. You can have hair loss with hyperthyroidism, but it's a little bit different. Your hair is actually brittle and it's breaking. Your nails also get brittle and break. You have very frequent bowel movements, feel anxious, not sleeping well at night, have a little bit of insomnia, very hot and sweaty as well, and significant weight loss. You feel like you're very hungry all the time, but regardless of how much you're eating, you're still losing weight.
Euthyroid.
Yeah, so euthyroidism is when your thyroid hormone levels are normal in your body. When they're right at goal, everything seems to be functioning well with the thyroid, we call that euthyroidism.
And how do we know when someone, in other words, how does a doctor know when someone is having those conditions? And is it a blood test primarily? In other words, to look at how the thyroid is functioning.
So when we're talking about diagnosing the thyroid dysfunction in somebody in terms of are there too high of levels or too low of levels, we do that with a blood test. And the blood test is called TSH, which stands for thyroid stimulating hormone. So we check that. It's not a fasting lab. It can be checked any time of day. And we look at that number. And that's going to tell us, like I said before, if the level is too high, that actually indicates that you're hypothyroid. And if the level is too low, that means you're hyperthyroid.
So it's a fairly simple test, if it's just the blood test, to go from there, correct?
Oh, yeah, very much so.
All right, so once you get those results, what's the next thing in terms of a workup if you do have an abnormality?
So with hypothyroidism, we check the TSH, and if it shows that you are in the hypothyroid range, then we want to find out what's causing this. Typically, hypothyroidism, the most common cause of it is an autoimmune condition called Hashimoto's disease. And so that is where the immune system kind of has revved up and it's targeted the thyroid and it's destroying it as if it's like an infection or a disease that shouldn't be there. And so your immune system starts to break down the thyroid. And as those cells die off, then you slowly become hypothyroid over time. We can check that by checking what are called antibodies in the blood. So there's certain antibodies that are linked to Hashimoto's disease. We can check those and then know that that was what the cause of the hypothyroidism was. The other most common cause of the hypothyroidism is if the thyroid has been surgically removed or it's been treated with radioactive iodine to destroy it for some other cause.
When we think of having a thyroid biopsy, what's involved in doing that?
A thyroid biopsy? So a thyroid biopsy is when somebody has thyroid nodules, and which is kind of an abnormal growth within the thyroid. When we see nodules on an ultrasound of the thyroid, we want to sample the cells within there to make sure there's no type of cancer or anything abnormal. And the way we do that is we have, you know, very small needles. They're a little bit bigger than the type of needle you would have a vaccine with. We look at the thyroid with an ultrasound, and we poke the needle into the nodule a couple of times, move it around a bit to loosen up those cells, and then we send it off to a pathologist, a specialist in looking at those cells, to look and see if there were any abnormalities.
Is that something that could be done in the office, or does it have to be done in a surgery center or an operating room?
It can be done in an office, in an outpatient setting, and I do lots of those in my practice.
Can we talk a little bit about some of the conditions affecting the thyroid, specifically thyroid cancer? And my understanding is that it's a fairly common cancer that we see, and we're seeing more in young people. Is that true?
So, yeah, we do see quite a bit of thyroid cancer. I don't think that it's, you know, it's not off the charts prevalent in the population here. You know, thyroid nodules themselves are very, very common. So thyroid nodules we see in about 25% of the population. So that means one in every four people will have a thyroid nodule. The vast majority of thyroid nodules are completely benign and don't have any cancer. The risk of thyroid cancer in a nodule is about 5 to 10%. And if you do have thyroid nodules, it's very important that you get an ultrasound, because the ultrasound can allow us to what we call risk stratify those nodules. So we can give a risk of thyroid cancer in the nodule based on what we see on the ultrasound. And if the risk of thyroid cancer in that nodule gets up above about 20%, that's when we recommend doing a biopsy.
What about the risk factors for thyroid cancer? Do we see it more in certain populations, men, women? Are there particular risk factors people need to know about?
So thyroid cancer is much more prevalent in females than in males. Thyroid disease and thyroid cancer are more prevalent in elderly females. And the one of the major risk factors for thyroid cancer is radiation. And so when I say radiation, I don't mean the type of radiation that you would get from an X-ray or a CAT scan. I mean the radiation that you would get from a different type of cancer treatment. Say that you had a previous cancer of the head or the neck and you had radiation for that. That would increase your risk of getting a thyroid cancer later in life. And another risk factor is if you have a relative, a first-degree relative, that also had thyroid cancer.
Okay. Well, switching gears, how about autoimmune conditions? We often hear about Hashimoto's thyroiditis. I mean, I see that a lot and when patients present. Can you talk a little bit about Hashimoto's and what we know about autoimmune thyroid conditions?
So Hashimoto's is the most common cause of hypothyroidism. And Hashimoto's is when your immune system, essentially, it makes these things called antibodies that target the thyroid and start destroying the thyroid, breaking it down. In some people, what that looks like is the thyroid kind of just starts to disappear. So when you do an ultrasound and you look in the where the thyroid normally would be, you don't really see much or you see a very small gland. In other people, it presents with the thyroid gland actually being replaced by scar tissue. So the thyroid gets very firm, sometimes enlarged. And when we look at it with an ultrasound, we see these kind of fibrous bands going through it. That's the scar tissue that's formed. And so the Hashimoto's disease, it presents with hypothyroidism. So the thyroid isn't functioning quite as well as it should. Your TSH on your blood test would be high, and you would be having those symptoms, the fatigue, the difficulty concentrating, hair loss, dry skin, constipation, all of those symptoms we had talked about.
I had a question from Bob that just came in, and actually something you touched on was iodine. And why is iodine important for thyroid function, was the question.
So iodine is important for thyroid function because iodine is one of the precursors to thyroid hormones. So in order for your body to make thyroid hormone, you need to have sufficient iodine, therefore, for making that thyroid hormone. But here in this country, if you eat a normal kind of typical American diet, it's very difficult to be deficient in iodine because the table salt that we use has iodine in it. And most of the processed foods that we eat, they have some of that salt within them. So you get enough iodine through just eating a normal diet.
So would you see it more in developing countries as
Definitely.
Opposed to in the United States?
Oh, yeah, definitely. In developing countries where there's a vastly different diet and using a lot of well water, we often will see iodine deficiency. And many times how it will present is the development of a goiter, which is a very enlarged thyroid.
Moving on a little bit, one of the symptoms we often hear from patients who have developed thyroid disease is sudden weight gain. Is that one of the earlier signs that you'll see of somebody with thyroid disease?
Yeah, so that's actually one of the most common complaints I see in my practice is people come in and they say, I had been gaining weight, couldn't explain why I was gaining weight and feeling very tired. And then we checked my levels and I'm hypothyroid. So it is one of the early presenting signs of hypothyroidism.
Let's move on a little bit to treatment. So how do you typically treat this variety of thyroid conditions?
So hypothyroidism, we treat by giving back thyroid hormone. So it's just a pill that contains the hormone that your body would normally make but is unable to make it. And the dose of that you go on is dependent on how much functional thyroid tissue, so how much of your thyroid is still working. Some people, they come to us with only some of their thyroid not working, but a lot of it still working on its own. So they need very small doses, like 25 micrograms or 50 micrograms of levothyroxine. That's the name of the thyroid hormone. We would consider that a low dose. But then other people, they come to us with their thyroid not functioning at all. They have no innate thyroid function. They can't make any thyroid hormone themselves. So then they go on a full, what we call weight-based dose of levothyroxine. And we, you know, we do kind of a calculation where we use your ideal body weight in kilograms, and we multiply that by 1.6 micrograms, and that gives us a dose of levothyroxine that we would use for you.
When someone has had thyroidectomy, so say they had cancer and the thyroid is removed, can they have adequate thyroid replacement to get back to normal function?
Yes, definitely. So when somebody's had their thyroid removed, if say it was, they had an overactive thyroid and it couldn't be controlled with medications and they had to go for surgery or they had a thyroid cancer, afterwards, we put them on medication that replaces the thyroid hormone, and we watch those levels in the blood frequently. We check them every 6 weeks, and we make sure that we get that TSH to where we want it to be, to a good goal level where they're feeling good, the levels are good, and everything's functioning well.
If someone has thyroid cancer, can this lead to other types of cancers? Are there other associated types of malignant conditions or cancers that are associated? So when someone has thyroid cancer, do you have to look for other types of cancer?
So typically, the most common types of thyroid cancer, there's actually four different types of thyroid cancer. And the two most common types are what we call papillary and follicular thyroid cancer. Papillary being the most common type of thyroid cancer. And papillary thyroid cancer itself is not associated with the development of other types of cancers. It can sometimes spread. Very rarely does it spread, but it can spread. The most common place of spread would be the lungs. But it's not associated with any type of syndrome that has multiple different cancers. There's one type of thyroid cancer called medullary thyroid cancer, which is rare. It's very rarely seen, and it is associated with a syndrome called multiple endocrine neoplasia that can run in families, and that is associated with other types of, you know, endocrine disorders and cancers.
In the follicular type, does that lead to other cancers as well, or is it more like the papillary type?
More like the papillary. It doesn't lead to other types of cancers.
Okay. What's one thing our listeners need to know about the thyroid that they probably don't know right now?
So one thing, that I do think is important is to pay attention to your symptoms, because hypothyroidism, it is very common. It's most common in older adults, particularly older women. The incidence of hypothyroidism in women over the age of 65 is about 5 to 15%. So I would just like to recommend that everybody pay attention to your symptoms. If you do feel you're having some symptoms where your thyroid may be off, speak to your primary care doctor. Ask your primary care doctor to check your TSH levels. And, you know, if you do have hypothyroidism, then you can seek out an endocrinologist.
Pam, in wrapping up, can you tell people a little bit about your practice, how they can reach out to you? And actually, how did you get the name Monarch Endocrinology?
My family actually came up with the name. The monarch butterfly actually has some special meaning to my family. And then we also decided on that because the thyroid gland resembles a butterfly.
And how do people reach out to you if they're interested in making an appointment or becoming involved with your practice?
So my practice is located in Enfield, Connecticut. We are at 146 Hazard Ave in Enfield. And if you'd like to make an appointment, you can reach out at any time over the phone. Our phone number is 860-386-5167.
And do people need a referral, or they could just refer themselves to be seen in your office?
They can be referred themselves. There's no need for an official referral.
That's great. Pam, thank you. Thank you for your time today. And thank you. I really want to follow this progress, and hopefully we'll be in touch because I think it's a great thing, and I think I'm hoping that more people do take that jump of getting out there into solo private practice and improving access for patients. Thank you again for your time.
Thanks so much, Tony. You have a great day. Thanks for having me on.
Thanks. We're going to take a short break. Then we'll be back to wrap things up. You're listening to Healthy Rounds on WTIC News Talk 1080. We're back on Healthy Rounds and want to wrap things up today's show. First of all, one thing, wanted to make sure of people who wanted to look up Korea, okay? It is C-H-O-R-E-A and not like the country Korea. So we talked about Sydenham's Korea. I want to take this time to wish everybody happy Father's Day. Tomorrow's Father's Day, and it's time to really reflect on our fathers, both alive, deceased, stepfathers, and people who have served in the role of father to all of us. Many thanks to our studio producer, Kevin Kors, has been on the board today. Joey Burgoyne really helped us put our show together. Jeff Chandler's in charge of sales and marketing for Healthy Rounds. As always, if you have questions for me during the week, you can reach out at info@alessimd.com. If you missed any part of today's program with Dr. Ori Zazamia, you can get it on the Healthy Rounds podcast. That's generally going to be posted around Tuesday of this week. Until next week, this is Dr. Anthony Alessi. Please stay healthy.
This has been Healthy Rounds with Dr. Anthony Alessi, sponsored by Hartford Healthcare, Rochford Eye Center, St. Francis Hospital, Covaris, and UConn Health Orthopedics and Sports Medicine. Be sure to tune in next Saturday morning at 11 for more Healthy Rounds on WTIC News Talk 1080 and WTIC.com. Till then, stay well.